This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker. With me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And here in the United States, in transit to our offices in Oklahoma, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
We're going to start with a shakeup in Washington that could have implications for many nations, Iran, Israel, and many other nations as well. John Bolton is gone. Donald Trump's hawkish national security advisor left over disagreements with the president. To talk about why and what this may mean going forward, we'll turn to Brent.
Yeah, we've often spoken about how that John Bolton was really somebody that brought a strong approach to foreign policy for the United States in this critical position inside the American cabinet, advising the president on how to best deal with the foreign actors that are most destabilizing on the planet, be them North Korea or Iran in particular. And so we saw it as a pretty strong move for President Trump in terms of how he would proceed to push back against these regimes that received a lot of a free pass, especially in terms of Iran coming from the previous president's administration. John Bolton is notorious for speeches at the UN when he was the UN ambassador for the United States to the UN in supporting Israel, coming up against Russia, coming up against Iran. And so to lose him at this juncture is pretty important in terms of the direction of American foreign policy, in terms of how hard it will be now, how hard-nosed it will be to some of these regimes. He left for a number of reasons. The last two straws, it seems, for him was the fact that the president was entertaining the idea, or not entertaining, was going to bring the Taliban to Camp David in the United States to discuss a peace negotiation that would end up with American troops withdrawing from Afghanistan. And John Bolton almost flipped. We probably did flip out over this, that they would come to the U.S. During the time just around September 11th, the Taliban, of course, harboring al-Qaeda for so long. And Bolton didn't like that. Eventually, they didn't come anyway because Taliban decided to kill a bunch of people to try and increase their negotiating position inside Afghanistan. But then the final straw was the rumors that the president was considering entering negotiations, renewed negotiations with the Iranian regime later on this month. And this was something, obviously, that Bolton has been dead set against for such a long time, because he believes that you can't negotiate with Iran until there are some severe changes that are made, where the president was going to open the door to Iran straight away, or at least right now, before there has been any noticeable change in Iran's behavior.
So does this suggest that Donald Trump... And the way this all played out, I guess it's a little bit awkward between them. But does it show that Donald Trump is going to take a softer approach to Iran and other places?
Well, I mean, a softer approach, yes. I think everybody kind of agrees that Bolton was the strongest man. Even Javad Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran, talked about Bolton leading the B team that was kind of goading President Trump towards war against Iran. If only he left, then President Trump could be dealt with in a negotiation. And it seems like President Trump has basically followed that line of reasoning from the Iranian foreign minister. Now, I'm not going to say, and nobody's is saying, that Trump is going to, you know, be President Obama in terms of Iran, but he does classify himself as the deal maker. He does believe that every problem can be solved by negotiation, especially if you have him in that negotiating chair. Mm-hmm. And Bolton disagreed with that fundamentally in terms of Iran, because Iran, and even as Melanie Phillips pointed out so much better than I did in her article today about this, Iran cannot be negotiated with away from their fundamental positions that they are a radical regime that believes on taking over the Middle East. And they win all the negotiations that they ever have. They haven't lost a negotiation in 40 years. They've lost some wars, but not negotiations. And so if President Trump believes that he can bring them to the table and come up with a deal that will be long-lasting in terms of security for the Middle East, that is trying to do what nobody else has been able to accomplish. And something like that does sound good to the president. So if you're in Israel right now, you are seeing this as a bad move in terms of Iran. Bolton's policy on Iran was virtually identical to Netanyahu's policy on Iran. And Netanyahu has been watching Iran since 1979. He correctly called the takeover there as being something that is going to be the greatest destabilizing act to the Middle East, and it has been. Mm-hmm. And so his 40 years of policy, Netanyahu, before he was prime minister, was how do we counter Iran's rise? Bolton felt the same way. He might not have said that he wanted regime change, but they both understand that a regime change in Iran is the only way to solve the Iranian issue, and the president does not believe that. He said as much this week. He said that his door is going to be open towards negotiations, and so it's not going to be Obama, but any negotiation with Iran is not a good idea at this point.
So Brent's obviously looking at this through the lens of the Middle East, and he's looking at how this will affect Iran, Israel. How does a Bolton departure look as far as the rest of the world is concerned?
Well, I think in North Korea, it's a very analogous situation to that in Iran, because Bolton was he was just a very hawkish in his stance toward the North Koreans. He was well known to them. The North Koreans even singled him out quite frequently as they called him a war maniac. They called him human scum because he refused to make any concessions. He didn't want to negotiate with the North Koreans in the slightest until they had fully denuclearized. He had openly advocated even for a preemptive strike against the regime of North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. And so now that he is removed, I believe the North Koreans will feel that they can have a lot more flexibility with President Trump. They'll expect Trump to be softened up quite a bit and possibly make some major concessions, lifting some sanctions on North Korea even before they make any real moves toward denuclearization.
Yeah, same story in Venezuela. Actually, on Wednesday, President Trump, he got up and made comments that he said Bolton's strategy on North Korea was an absolute disaster, and he was out of line on Venezuela, specifically pointing in North Korea's case that it was Bolton's militaristic approach that was making the Koreans less willing to negotiate. Didn't wax into as much detail on Venezuela, but Bolton's stance was definitely you need to use the threat of U.S. military force to force Nicolas Maduro out of office. And then he labeled Honduras, Cuba, and Venezuela together as the troika of tyranny, saying they're basically indicating that we need regime change in all three of those Latin American nations to foster security in the United States. And so now with Bolton out, I think President Trump might still want to pursue regime change in Venezuela, but it looks like it may be much less of a using the threat of military force as a lever for that, and instead trying to negotiate with Russia and possibly the Catholic Church to come up with a deal to bring into power a transitional government. The Catholic Church has been involved for a couple years now trying to come up with a deal that would get a pro-European government into power in Venezuela that still honored Russia and China's oil contracts and kind of get this patch together, this thing that will work for everyone, which, as we've reported before, is very prophetic. In the fact that there's this prophecy in Deuteronomy 28:52 about end time Israel, the United States and Britain primarily being besieged in all your gates, and America's most important trade gates flow through the Caribbean Sea, of which Venezuela sits on the southern shore of. And so if the United States starts pulling back, taking a more softline approach in there, and comes up with a deal that lets Europe, China, Russia, or maybe even all three increase their political, economic, even military ties in the region, is just one step closer to having a foreign power being able to besiege America in those gates.
Well, I guess we'll see what happens. Obviously, President Trump had enough similarity with John Bolton's thinking that he hired him to begin with. Maybe their differences were a little more than what John Bolton and the president were able to stomach. But it does seem like there would have to be at least a certain amount of continuity. I wouldn't expect that John Bolton's departure would result in a wholesale change. Any thoughts, Brent?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I don't want to end up saying that the whole high-pressure campaign against Iran is going to be gone. Pompeo is pretty strong on Iran as well, the Secretary of State. I guess it's the way that they are going to go about receiving their goals. And one believes that negotiation is a very important part of going forward. The other believes that you really have to bring some of these regimes to their knees and have a credible threat of force backing you.
Yeah.
And really, there was no point having Bolton in there anymore, I would say, just because Iran knows, Israel knows, everyone in the region, the Middle East knows that President Trump has got no stomach for any type of military action in the Middle East, a substantial one. And so to really have him there, it might have been quite annoying for Mr. Trump to have Bolton in his ear talking about that need, since he wasn't going to do that, since he is fundamentally an isolationist in a way, wanting American power to stay within American gates. I would just say, thinking about Bible prophecy, just to bring this in terms of Iran, we did say, going even at the beginning of this high-pressure campaign, even at the beginning of Bolton's hiring, that this does look good for countering Iran. He was making the necessary moves to slow down Iran's rise. But we said at the same time that Bible prophecy indicates that Iran will not change its stripes. There will be no regime change. Mm-hmm. And really, Bolton's firing points to that fact, that there is no fundamental change to Iran, although Iran still might be slowed in its progress towards a nuclear bomb or slowed in its progress across the Middle East. So that's definitely something that we can take away from this, is to look at those prophecies as being the fundamental reality, that Iran is the king of the South. It's going to maintain its strength in the region regardless of American policy.
That's a very good point, a good point to finish on. And I'd like to direct your attention toward Brent's article that was up on the website this week. Iran rejoices, Israel braces, the B team is no more. The B team being Bolton and Bibi Netanyahu, I guess. Go check that article out on the website for a little more of the context prophetically. And thank you very much for bringing that story to us, Brent. More developments on the Brexit front this week. To catch us up to speed, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, the story keeps rolling along, though this week it's a lot of, I guess, negative things not happening, things being blocked. So Britain will not be having new elections over the next few weeks. Parliament successfully blocked that on Monday. This was despite Parliament saying, and people like Jeremy Corbyn saying, we will allow fresh elections if this surrender bill that we were trying to get through goes through, we'll allow them. The bill went through, they didn't allow them. And then the very next day, Labour politicians went back to calling for elections, again, despite having voted against them the day before. We also had a court case in Scotland which ruled that the suspension of Parliament was illegal. So there's been a lot of the anti-EU or the pro-EU crowd, the anti-Brexit crowd has been crowing about that. That's been on the news pretty much 24/7. Basically, even some of the organizers behind this court case trying to say that Boris Johnson behaved illegally said they went shopping around to try and find where they would have the best chances of judges agreeing with them. They decided on Scotland. They launched a court case in Scotland arguing that suspending Parliament was illegal. They agreed with them, but it now goes to the Supreme Court in the UK, who are almost certainly going to say, no, it wasn't illegal, but we'll see that probably in the next week. Then another big development we saw for this story is that John Bercow, one of the Speaker of the House of Commons, one of the key individuals that's been trying to stop Britain from leaving the EU, he announced he was stepping down. But the reason for this looks like he was stepping down so that he can, at a time of his choosing, so he can try and make sure that his successor will also work hard and bend the rules to try and keep Britain out of the EU. But I think the most significant thing to take from all of these different stories that we saw this week is that we're starting to see now a much more clear end game for those pro-EU leaders. That what their long-term plans are for Brexit. So that end game looks like they want a second referendum, but that second referendum, a proper Brexit, won't be an option on that vote. You know, they've tried that. People chose the quote-unquote the wrong answer, the answer the elites in Britain don't like. So instead, there'll be a second referendum, and the options would be either stay in the EU or leave with this deal that pro-EU figures have worked out that will be very similar to staying in the EU. So they seem like they're going to now try and stop elections, stop the Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and then really focus on trying to get this referendum through, and that way, in their minds, permanently stop Brexit.
It's quite extraordinary to see just how similar what's happening in Britain is to what we see in the United States, where you have this very vicious and bitter war taking place between what the populace wants, or a significant part of the populace, and what the elites in the government and in academia want, where they know what they feel is best for the people, and the lengths that they're willing to go to defy the will of the people in order to enforce their view is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, it really is remarkable how clearly you're seeing the same kind of trends that you see in the United States. Right, it's exactly the same thing as you mentioned. One of the points Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry made about what we're seeing here in the States, he had an article called What the University Scam Reveals About America. And he mentioned that you have an elite that, well, as he put it, think they're destined to rule the universe. In most cases, he wrote, they're not elected officials, nobody voted for them, but they consider themselves the only ones qualified to govern. In the US, they cannot believe a barbarian like Donald Trump became president, and they cannot take it, so they must overthrow him. In the UK, they cannot believe that you would have people vote for Brexit, this liberal, modern, elitist project. And so they're voting against it. And you know, another point that Mr. Flurry's pointed to repeatedly is, you know, you look at the spiritual reality described in the Bible, and it talks about a devil, and it talks about a devil trying to work to bring down Britain, bring down America. And this kind of arrogance that you see from these elites of, well, we know absolutely best, we're not going to be bound by any laws, any popular votes, nothing's going to restrain us, that's something that Satan can really, really use and really, really work with. And so he's working with that in both nations, with people that have that kind of attitude, to bring those nations down. In America, by undermining the rule of law, in the UK, you know, certainly that, but just trying to shackle Britain into this European Union, that's something else the Bible talks about as being in one of his tools, something he's raising up. So you see the same attack from the same source in both Britain and the US being done in a very similar way, and that's why you see some of these similarities.
Now, as far as we can tell, Boris Johnson isn't backing down. He seems to have quite a lot of pluck and fight in him, and nothing that the people who are trying to oppose him have done has derailed the plans to leave to this point. Is that right?
Well, kind of. The surrender bill is still a bit up in the air. This bill that basically says that the Prime Minister, if there's no deal agreed by the middle of October, he has to go to Europe and ask for another 3-month extension. I think he's looking at, and his team is looking at, well, what can they do to get around that? He has said that he would rather be dead in a ditch than comply with that bill, with that law, I guess it is now as it's passed. So, you know, that's the big conflict right now. Well, what is he going to do? How is he going to find a way to get Britain out on October 31st? And it seems like he's kind of gone with renewed vigor now into getting a deal, because if he does have a deal, then that surrender bill doesn't come into force.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will definitely keep our eyes on that situation. In the meantime, we'll put a link to Gerald Fleury's article, What the University Scam Reveals About America, that Richard just referenced. But also, Richard wrote an article that went up, a trumpet brief that went out on September 10th. It's up on the front page of the website, The Battle for Brexit, Elites Versus the People. Go check that out at thetrumpet.com. And thank you for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. China continues to score victories in its quest to dominate the South China Sea. This week, it was the Philippines agreeing to cooperate in a joint project in Philippine waters. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has just returned from a visit to Beijing, and he said on Tuesday that the Philippines is now planning to move forward with a plan to work with China to extract its both oil and gas from parts of the South China Sea that are within the Philippines' exclusive economic zone. So this is it's near the resource-rich Reed Bank in the Philippines territory there. Duterte said Chinese President Xi Jinping agreed to give the Philippines 60% of the revenue that results from these hydrocarbons, and China will keep the other 40%. But for China, this is really less about extracting this energy than it is about politics. It's about China wanting to force nations that border the South China Sea into entering into these joint exploration deals, because by doing so, these nations kind of implicitly acknowledge China's claims over the South China Sea there. So it's really a political move for China. But for the Philippines, though, it truly is just about needing this oil and gas. They're somewhat desperate to be able to mine it, and China has blocked the Philippines' attempts to get other nations to help them extract it. So the Philippines kind of had a choice to either give up on extracting the gas, especially from their waters, or to do it with China and thereby lend legitimacy to China's ludicrous and illegitimate claims over what is essentially Philippine territory. So the Philippines was in a tight spot, but I think the fact that Duterte is giving in to China really shows kind of a defeatist attitude there. And I think many of the other smaller Asian nations share in those sentiments. And as China grows more and more powerful, and as the U.S.'s resolve and kind of that isolationist mentality that the U.S. is taking that Brent spoke about, as that continues to strengthen, I think we'll see more of these kinds of concessions to China.
Now, you just referenced the illegitimacy of China's claims in that area, and that was actually backed up by a ruling in 2016 by The Hague that specifically said that, and this is essentially negating that. Maybe you could just tell us about that.
Sure, yeah. This was a landmark ruling. 2016, the Permanent Court of Arbitration basically invalidated China's claims, and they backed the Philippines' claims. Duterte, up until now, has been essentially silent about that ruling, which in itself was a concession to China, just his silence. But now he's gone beyond silence. And he has specifically said this week that that the Philippines will ignore that court ruling. So the ruling confirmed what the UN Convention on the Law of the Seas had long said, which was that China's nine-line claims are ludicrous and utterly invalid. That's the line that China apparently found on some ancient map, nine dashes drawn around pretty much the entire South China Sea. China says, because of this map, we can tell that we have a historic claim to this area. So China, of course, never accepted The Hague's ruling. And just a few weeks ago, Duterte said he would raise the issue of that ruling with China and push China with it. But instead, he's made an apparent U-turn now. And he said the Philippines also rejects the ruling. So it's a sobering sign, I think, of just how desperate the Philippines feels and of how long the shadow that China casts in this area has grown.
If you could just explain why this is important prophetically.
Sure, yes. In the Trumpet's July 2016 print edition, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury wrote a very powerful article called China is Steering the World Toward War. And it says that China's takeover of the South China Sea should alarm the world. And he explains that the South China Sea is among the world's busiest maritime locations. About a third of the world's maritime commerce flows through it. So it would be just a catastrophic loss, not just for the U.S., but for the world, were China to succeed in its goal of controlling it. And Mr. Fleury said that could very quickly lead to war. And he said that this is soon going to contribute to the fulfillment of a Bible prophecy about modern-day America and Britain being besieged by China and other nations. Andrew spoke about that very prophecy a moment ago. It's in Deuteronomy 28:52. And in that article, Mr. Fleury says that China's takeover of the South China Sea is one of many areas today where onlookers can, quote, already see this prophecy moving toward its fulfillment. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. China is steering the world toward war. We'll put a link to that in the show notes for the program today. China is also making a deal with Argentina that could damage American farmers who are already suffering. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is really a game-changing deal, at least in the couple-year-long time frame that China made on Wednesday with Argentina, where they signed this deal to buy soy meal from Argentine farmers. The shipments will probably start kicking in next year. It's going to take them a little bit of time to get processing plants and things like that start crushing this soy meal. But that's kind of the headline that, unless you're in the soybean industry, you'd read right over. With this soy meal deal, but this is soybeans is one of America's major agricultural exports. I actually think it's our biggest agricultural export. I know corn and soybeans are the top two, and most of it goes America's foreign exports of soybeans go to China, and so that's the context behind this deal. Is that America's been selling these soybeans to China, but because of the trade war, we're putting tariffs on goods from China coming here. They're putting tariffs on goods from America going to China. And the Chinese have deliberately targeted soybean farmers because they know they're a demographic that votes Republican. And it's a way to hurt President Trump specifically in this trade war. But so China's made announcements that they're not buying American soybeans for the time being. And in the meantime, they've been shifting to Brazil to fill the gap. And now even getting deals and frameworks in place to buy from Argentina so that there's a really good chance that even if President Trump is able to make a deal with China to get those tariffs taken away, at least temporarily, they may never get that the agricultural market back, as the processing plants and stuff like that are being built to use the southern cone of South America as China's new breadbasket, if you will, instead of the Great Plains of the United States.
So we were talking just last Friday, I believe, about how suicides among American farmers are increasing. We're already in a pretty tough climate for American agriculture. Put what's happening here in the larger context.
Right, yeah, because American farmers have definitely had been hit coming and going for the past a few years because of increasing agricultural production in Russia and in Brazil and in Argentina. The price of farm commodities, soybeans and corn, has gone down to the point where it was already hard for farmers to make a living because they're selling their crops for so low prices. Then you had the trade war come along, which means that now even with the low prices, you still can't sell your even more of your produce because there's nations like China that aren't buying. And then on top of the low prices and the trade war, you had this massive flood come right at the back in the beginning of the year in the middle of America's breadbasket, which destroyed a lot of the soybeans that they had stored because they couldn't sell. And so between the three of those things, they think they said that, if I've got the statistics, if you go in the ninth district of the United States, that's Minnesota, Montana, in North and South Dakota and Wisconsin, right in the heart of like soybean country. Farm bankruptcies have hit their highest level in two decades. And then, like I said, we talked last week that the suicide rate amongst farmers, ranchers, agricultural managers is about double the average suicide rate in the nation as well. And a number of studies have linked that to just financial problems amongst the U.S. farming community, which is and I mean, there's many prophecies that talk about the significance of that. I think the one we talked about last week was in Joel 1 that was specifically more about the natural disasters that take out America's harvest and cause farmers to just mourn and lament the loss of their livelihood. Today we've been hitting that Deuteronomy 28:52 pretty hard. We talked about it a bit in the John Bolton section about America losing its gates in the Caribbean. Jeremiah talked about it a bit in the South China Sea about America losing gates in the South China Sea. But even this is also works into that prophecy, not so much about losing the actual geographic gate as you are losing the markets that go through that gate. Normally, I mean, American soybeans normally flow out those gates, and then Chinese money flows into them. And so when you get in a trade war like this, it's also, it's being a type of besiegement that's right now devastating America's agriculture industry. Some of our other industries are doing better, but the prophecy indicates that those types of problems will spread to even other American industries as the economy gets worse and worse because of America's rebellion against God.
Where would you send people for more information, Andrew?
Actually, I think for this one, it's probably easy to go big picture and go straight to the United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong that spends many chapters explaining the proofs showing that the United States is descended from ancient Israel, the blessings and cursings listed in Deuteronomy 28, including this being besieged in their gates, apply directly to them. And that's why all of these news events are prophetically significant.
We'll put a link to that in the show notes. And also, Andrew has this article that he put up just a week or so ago, Why Are U.S. Farmers Killing Themselves? That has quite a bit of information about the problems facing the agricultural sector in America today. Thanks for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Before we take a short break, I want to mention Jeremiah Jacques is not just a panelist on Trumpet Hour. He's the host of his own program on Trumpet Radio called The Sun Also Rises. You can find it at the Listen tab at thetrumpet.com. Tomorrow, September 14th, is Star Spangled Banner Day, the anniversary of the writing of America's national anthem. Jeremiah's newest program tells the story of that anthem and highlights just how extraordinary it is in both history and in substance. He interviews Mark Ferris, who authored The Star-Spangled Banner, The Unlikely Story of America's National Anthem. It's a really interesting program. I'd encourage you to go listen to it and start following Jeremiah's show. It's called The Sun Also Rises because it focuses on good news and positive, uplifting stories, which we appreciate considering all the negativity in so much of the news. So take a listen to Jeremiah's program, The Sun Also Rises. We'll be right back.
Is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is up for re-election next week, and this week he made a bold promise. To learn about this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, the Prime Minister of Israel decided that he is going to annex part of the West Bank if he wins the election next Tuesday. This is a pretty big deal in some ways. In other ways, it isn't. It's being made out to be a huge deal in terms of the press that it's getting mostly from out of Israel. Just understanding what these terms mean, basically this area from the Jordan River all the way through till Jerusalem is known as the West Bank today, the West Bank of the Jordan River. This is an area that Jordan controlled or occupied, if you want to call it that way, if you want to call it, from 1949 through to 1967. This was an area that Israel then won in the Six-Day War, pushing Jordan back to the other side of the Jordan River. And it's become known as the West Bank. And since that time, Israel has not declared it Israeli territory in the sense of Jerusalem, West Jerusalem, if you like, or Tel Aviv, or even now what they declare the Golan Heights as being their territory. It has not been formally annexed as part of their nation, although Israel has maintained control of it. So in any future Palestinian state, in terms of a two-state solution, this area, including part of the West Bank, it was believed that that would be a Palestinian state next door to an Israeli state. Yet this strip of land that he's talking about annexing isn't all of the West Bank, isn't all of the area that was going to be a Palestinian state, but it's basically this area that's inside the valley of the Jordan Valley that separates Jordan from Israel. And Israel has maintained that this is an important security barrier, that in any future Palestinian state or any deal, Israel is still going to maintain the security along this line, because Israel cannot afford to have Iran all the way on the border of Jerusalem. Instead, Iran would be on the border of Jordan if it ever overruns Jordan. And so while this is a big deal in terms of Israel is saying, no, this territory is going to belong to us no matter what, everyone knows that in any type of future peace deal, Israel would still maintain military control over it. Nevertheless, it does start picking at some parts of the West Bank that Israel says going forward it is always going to be Israeli territory.
So why do you suppose he's making this announcement right now, Brent?
Because it's popular. Everyone wants to come out and say that Netanyahu is a right winger, that he's crazy and he's a warmonger, same as Bolton, I suppose. But the Israeli public understand the need to maintain their security on their eastern flank. And so this means that he's saying this because he thinks that this is going to be a winning election idea, that if he does that, more people would vote for him. Even Benny Gantz, who leads the opposition, is basically complaining that Netanyahu stole what he was going to do. So the other side of it all wants this as well. Mm-hmm. And so what's really interesting is you're getting this just highlights the creation of this this concept of or the huge dichotomy between what the outside world thinks of Israel and what Israel thinks of itself. Israel, as across the political spectrum, understands the dangers that it faces in the region. It understands what Iran is doing. That's why the left in Israel gets in terms of security, 8 seats. Most parties, if they want to win in Israel, are going to have a right wing or a strong defensive portfolio. That's why generals, be it the Blue and White Party, Benny Gantz, next general, Ehud Barak's now running, is on the Labor side or on the leftist side. But in security, he's a general. Israel believes in its necessity for its security. The world is trying to paint Israel as a state that's hell-bent on keeping the Palestinians down or making up this stuff about Iran when Israelis don't feel like that themselves. Mm-hmm. And so this might be a winning election strategy for the prime minister.
Well, yeah. How is Benjamin Netanyahu's prospects looking at this point?
Let's not even discuss it. Because if you want to ask the polls, they have him losing. But you can't trust them. They've been wrong in the past few elections. And so we'll see. I think there is a growing feeling in Israel that they would like a change, but they see Israel as being threatened continuously, and they do trust Netanyahu, who's done a good job at protecting them for so long, and so they would like to keep him in power. I still think he narrowly gets in power, and then we'll see what goes from there. I just read something that, in just anecdotal evidence, that people get called up by the pollsters here in Israel, and they make up something. They make up that they're going to vote for the guy that's anti-Netanyahu to then rise him in the polls, which then would swing when you come out to vote. People think, oh, no, Netanyahu's in trouble, and they'll go and vote Netanyahu. Yeah. So you never really know with these polls. The election's next Tuesday, and we're actually holding off on our Watch Jerusalem first, Watch Jerusalem magazine first issue, so that we know really how that is going to go, because it is so close right now. But I think in terms of Israel's security, it's good to remember that there is general consensus among Israel about the threats that they face. Those threats are real, and Israel's historical memory is far greater, I would say, or far better than other nations. They understand that historically they have been persecuted, and they must protect the Israeli state from its adversaries.
Just quickly, there's also the discussion about President Trump finally revealing his peace plan, but waiting until after the Israeli election. I suppose he wants to know who he's going to be dealing with on the Israeli side for sure. Any thoughts on how that might factor in?
It's really hard to know. It's really hard to know. We just lost Jason Greenblatt, who's been heading up the peace plan for the United States for the past 2 years. He left, he resigned before it's even come out. And so Israel has said that this was part of the peace plan anyway, what they have seen, that Israel was going to get to annex the Jordan Valley. And so it might not, it probably doesn't really throw a spanner in the works, although it might be a sign that Israel is trying to push, I would say right now we're in this really interesting time period where Israel is trying to maximize the fact that American support is there. And so they're going to do some historical things because they can't be guaranteed American support in the future, even after President Trump's second term, if he gets elected. There's really Mr. Netanyahu can do what he likes, and President Trump kind of has to support it because of the evangelical vote that he needs for the 2020 election. And the evangelicals vote for President Trump, at least in 2016, because of their love for Israel. Mm-hmm. And so Netanyahu has a moment where he can make these big announcements. He can annex this, and he might even push towards annexing the whole West Bank. I wouldn't be surprised. The whole world would be up in arms, but the tide is high, as Mr. Flurry has been saying right now, in terms of these moments when the support could be there for such monumental decisions. And so we'll see how it affects Mr. Trump. He hasn't come out and said that he's against it, but Israel might try and push this relationship as far as it will go.
We'll keep our eyes on it. Thanks very much for that, Brent. Pope Francis has been very outspoken in his criticism of America, certainly America's current president, but even America's economic system, its immigration policies, its environmental record. This week he mentioned that there might be some religious differences as well. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
At a press conference on Tuesday, Pope Francis said that he is not afraid of schism with U.S. Catholics. And just as a basic principle of human psychology, when someone dogmatically claims that they're not afraid of something, oftentimes that is a good indication that they actually are, at least a little bit. This comment was prompted on a flight. The Pope was visiting three different nations in Africa. He's on the flight back, and one of the reporters showed to him a new book that's out, that it's making its round through some Catholic circles, especially here in the U.S., titled How America Wanted to Change the Pope. And the book, the first couple chapters really focus in on the Pope's mishandling of the sex abuse scandals within the Catholic Church. And then by the time you get to chapter 3, you're looking at more of a historical context about the historic independent streak that American Catholics have had for over 200 years. The Pope, he definitely did not take much correction from anything that was in the book. I think he came out swinging, saying that it was an honor for him that Americans criticize him. Came in later saying that he's not, he doesn't necessarily think a schism is going to happen, but he's not afraid of one. What's the other comment? He said a schism is always snobbish ideology detached from doctrine. So he's definitely coming out strong that these more conservative critics in the American Catholic Church are, I think the word he used is like rigid, just rigid and out of line with what the direction he'd like to take the church in.
So why would it be significant that the Pope is so willing to demonstrate this divide between, say, his brand of Catholicism and Americans?
Right, and then some of these divisions he's talking about over things like his stance on homosexuals in the Catholic Church or immigration are broader divisions between conservative and liberal Catholics worldwide in general.
Right.
But some of them are fairly specific to the United States. Specifically the criticisms of like the Pope's economic policy being too socialist, the Pope's stance on climate change. I'm not saying there's not Catholics in other parts of the world who disagree with the Pope's stance on climate change or socialism, but that is this free market libertarian ideology is something that's much stronger in American conservative circles than it is in European conservative circles. Mm-hmm. And so you add those economic differences. The Pope even specifically referring to the American criticism, saying that I teach the same thing about the economy that Pope John Paul II did, and the Americans call me a communist.
Not the most accurate statement.
And John Paul II was, it's not completely accurate. I think this Pope is definitely more economically socialist than John Paul II, although Catholic social doctrine in general is probably more socialist than some of these American critics are giving it credence for.
Yeah.
But this does show that since the Founding Fathers' time, there's always been this, in America, this kind of back and forth where they're very devoted to religious freedom, but concerned about a group of religious people who are led by someone who's a head of state, the Vatican is a state. Mm. And so over the last few centuries, American Catholic culture has developed kind of uniquely to where they, you still follow the Catholic religious rituals, but you don't necessarily take the Pope's political statements on the economy or climate change as seriously as Catholics in a lot of other nations do.
Mm-hmm.
And,
so prophetically, we're expecting this kind of rift,
right? I'm not necessarily saying there's going to be an outright schism between the United States Catholic Church and the rest. I mean, it conceivably could happen that way, but there is definitely a prophecy in Isaiah 47 that talks about this this great church that sits as a lady of kingdoms and won't suffer the loss of daughters. So this is a political church that's historically ruled over nations, the past resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire, who's looking to get daughter churches or Protestant churches come back. But in verse 6 and 7, God specifically says that because he's wroth with his people, Israel, he turns them over to this lady of kingdoms, and she shows them no mercy. So this is a specific prophecy about God using the Catholic Church and the nations that follow it to punish end time Israel or the United States and Britain. And so you're kind of using this, using the logic that there's going to be a divide between America, I mean, and the Vatican. And now with some of these statements, you're even seeing a divide between the 1 in 5 Americans who are Catholic, or at least some of them, and the Vatican.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. The president of the European Commission unveiled her geopolitical strategy for Europe this week. To learn about it, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Ursula von der Leyen, the ex-German defense minister, is the new incoming president of the European Commission. She's been outlining her team and some changes that she is going to make to Europe coming up over the next few years. She's she has long been a really enthusiastic supporter of more European integration. She's often talked about this. As German defense minister, she was very strong in terms of a combined European military. She even talked about the long-term goal of creating a multinational panzer division to form the nucleus of a European army. So with what we've seen from her this week, puts a whole lot of that into practice. So one of the big things that she's unveiled is a plan to create a directorate general that covers Europeans' defense industry and space technology, so-called DG Defense. This would see Germany's military or Europe's military integration now get its own office in Brussels, get its own staff, get its own person who's single person who's in charge to help move this forwards. There's going to be a total of $16 billion towards satellite projects as well that comes in under that. And then she told, well, she said that we need to take further bold steps in the next 5 years towards a genuine European defense union. The European Union needs to be more strategic, more assertive, more united in its approach to external relations. There was another very interesting part of what she was doing that was unveiled where she created a new directorate that's responsible for migration. And what caught a lot of people's attention is the title she gave this directorate. It's the Office for Protecting Our European Way of Life. A lot of liberals scream blue murder at that. You know, the idea that migrants from the Middle East might undermine our European way of life is absolutely anathema to those that are in favor of this very multicultural, whoever will may come, kind of European Union. So her decision to say to title that, nope, the person who's in charge of immigration, his number one priority, it's in his job title, is protecting our way of life, making sure Europe kind of stays Christian and has this constant cultural background. That's a pretty big march to the right for a European Commission president to take, and something a lot of people are taking note of as well.
Well, very interesting. And we have an article that is being prepared. Daniel DeSanto is working on an article about this subject that should go up on the website within the next day or so. You can watch for that. A very interesting direction, more and more bold in the public pronouncements about how this is going to unfold for Europe going forward. We appreciate that. Richard, we have one last story before we finish. Back to China and its growing domination within Asia, specifically the South Pacific. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, China is in the process of convincing the archipelago nation called the Solomon Islands into switching its diplomatic allegiance from Taipei, Taiwan, to Beijing, China. China views Taiwan as a rogue province that belongs under the control of the Communist Party in the mainland. And China has made clear that it's willing to do whatever is necessary to bring Taiwan under its control. And one of the big strategies that China's used over the years has been picking off Taiwan's diplomatic allies. Since 2016, China has convinced Sao Tome and Principe, Panama, the Dominican Republic, Burkina Faso, and El Salvador all to switch allegiance. And each time one of these nations switches, it's basically saying, we agree with you, China. Taiwan should not be a sovereign, independent country. It's basically just a state of China. So if this is successful in the Solomon Islands, it would leave Taiwan with just 16 formal allies around the globe. And this also has a lot to do with China's military goals. China often convinces nations to switch to China from Taiwan by promising them huge sums of money to build infrastructure. And it lends them all this money, not despite the fact that many of these countries won't be able to pay it back, but because of that fact. China, this is sometimes called debt trap diplomacy. And China basically uses it to get nations like the Solomon Islands to default on their loans so that China can then move in and seize infrastructure and use that for military use. And if that happened in the Solomon Islands, it could really put Australia in a perilous situation vis-a-vis China, because the Solomon Islands lie along some of Australia's most important shipping lanes there. And our own Andrew Miller here wrote about this back in June. He said, Fiji, Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu, and the Solomon Islands sit astride the most vital shipping lanes in Australia. If China is able to militarize these shipping lanes, it'll be able to isolate Australia and become master of the South Pacific. And then he says, both history and biblical prophecy show why this is extremely dangerous.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that. And that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and the literature that we discussed today. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Brent, we're looking forward to seeing you soon here in Edmond. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Lois McMaster Bujold. An honor is not diminished for being shared. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.